been a flying disc has been found and is now in the possession of the Army.
Okay, well, let's see what's currently anyway, okay?
There's two of them, and they
stayed
in the exact same spot the whole time.
They're outside, like
say that.
Oh, my God, I hope that's a plane. Oh, Jesus, please be a plane. Oh, please. All right, Lisa, are you ready for this?
My cameraman said, what the hell is that midway across the Hudson River? It was a perfectly circular disc.
What a thing just hovering sort of 100 yards away.
For the first time in our history, we're studying something that's studying us.
Nobody told me that the days like these.
Suddenly, something else flew into the frame. Fired a beam of light that struck the dummy warhead, doing a circle, if you can imagine, circling our warhead. Fired another beam of light at it, which struck the warhead.
The Virtually Strange Network presents Strange Days Indeed, your premier source for UFO information, with your host, Errol Bruce Knapp.
Hello and welcome to edition 431 of These Here Strange Days Indeed, the second podcast-only version of the program. On the program this week, well, we've had a lot of requests from people who didn't hear the O'Hare International Airport programs that we ran back in January of this year. So in response to those emails, this week, the interviews that we did with Peter Davenport of the National UFO Reporting Center, along with Don Ledger, and John Hilkovich, the Chicago Tribune reporter, who broke the story back on January the 1st. We'll get to those, along with Dave Ferlot, as the program progresses. But first of all, an example of how the media treats UFO sightings. It was the 10th anniversary of the Phoenix Lights incidents. I say incidents because according to this radio station, there was only one.
This is KJZZ's Morning Edition. I'm Dennis Lambert. 10 years ago tonight, some Arizonans looked into the sky and saw a series of unusual lights.
Major sighting here.
Weird happenings in the skies over Phoenix recently, and no one seems to be able to explain what it was.
The phenomenon came to be known as the Phoenix Lights. The U.S. military says the lights were flares, but skeptics still claim the lights are evidence that we are not alone in the universe. KJZZ's Renee Gattell reports.
The Phoenix Lights keep midnight AM talk radio shows in business. Enter the conspiracy theorists and alien enthusiasts. If you listen to them, you'd think there was still some mystery and intrigue behind those bizarre lights a decade ago. But there's not, according to Jeff Hester. He's an astronomer at Arizona State University's School of Earth and Space Exploration. Hester has a PhD in space physics and astronomy. His specialty is star formation and how massive stars interact with their environments. So I asked him, what were the Phoenix Lights?
My understanding is that the Phoenix Lights were a series of flares that were dropped from an Air Force plane out west of the valley during a routine exercise. They were flares that were dropped on parachutes, and so they descended slowly, and eventually they burned out as flares are wont to do.
It seems like there's been kind of a cottage industry that sprung up around the Phoenix Lights, a documentary and a book. Does it surprise you that 10 years later people are still talking about it and speculating?
I wish I could say that it surprised me, but it doesn't in fact surprise me. The fact is that things like this crop up frequently. Anytime there's something interesting in the sky, the phones start ringing at places like mine and people wonder if it's the little green men coming to take them away.
He says sightings such as the Phoenix Lights are relatively frequent, and there are rational explanations, but he says the truth becomes irrelevant, and the story becomes the story, feeding off itself. The official Air Force explanation is sufficient for him, he says, because it makes sense. The brightness of the lights was consistent with the brightness of a flare at that distance, same for the speed.
You know, when you were a kid, hearing something go bump in the night did not prove that there were monsters in the closet. You know, usually if you heard something go bump in the night, you know, it was because there was a cat out crawling around in the trash can or something. And this is very much that kind of situation. People are fascinated with the idea of a connection between us and the sky.
Hester dismisses the Phoenix Lights as evidence of extraterrestrials flying over Arizona, but he does not dismiss the possibility of life somewhere else in the universe.
The number of stars in the part of the universe that we can see is a number that is much, much larger than the number of grains of sand on all of the beaches of all of Earth's oceans. It's a big number. That's an awful lot of chances for life to get a toehold elsewhere. On the other hand, saying that life has gotten a toehold elsewhere is not the same thing as saying that they show up in West Phoenix with gaudy displays just to see who then can make a buck off of a book or a movie about it.
Tonight, the Valley marks the 10th anniversary of the appearance of the Phoenix Lights, and you'll be seeing ads around town for discussions and film screenings about the event. Meanwhile, Jeff Hester will be doing what he's been doing for the past 25 years, teaching and learning about the stars. For KJZZ, I'm Renee Gattell.
Yeah, way to go, media woman. Hundreds, if not thousands, of witnesses saw boomerang or chevron-shaped objects in your part of Arizona 10 years ago, and the best you can do is trot out a scientist who is eminently unqualified to comment on flares dropped hours after those sightings. Oh, and he trots out little green men and things that go bump in the night, too. Yeah, that's real reporting, lady. Congratulations. What a disservice you foisted on your listening audience.
Strange days indeed. Dozens of sightings, reports, and experiences filed weekly with the Virtually Strange Network. Here is but a taste.
In real UFO-related news this week, Wendy Connors, longtime UFO researcher, the faded disc audio archive of UFO history curator, and regular contributor to this program, sent a post to the UFO Updates email list today, St. Patrick's Day, March 17th, which reads in part, "Due to continued health issues, I've reached the decision to retire from active participation in ufology. It was a very difficult decision, but I made it quickly. I don't like to waste time. I know I've retired before, but if prize fighters and politicians can do it, so can I." She goes on to say, "I will still haunt the SDI podcasts when I'm able and suggest that all of you shower Errol with subscriptions. He's one of the few beacons of light in this dark world for almost anyone to have their say, and this is very rare." Well, thank you, Wendy. Ah, Maya, you're retiring and you're still thinking of others. Also, Wendy's door in New Mexico is always open for researchers to visit, although her materials are now under the able protection and archives of Rod Dyke and will be made available to the research community after her passing. Well, once in a blue moon, Wendy says she'll produce another volume in the Audio History of Ufology series, but they won't be coming as rapidly as they did in the past. If you haven't paid attention to them, you should. They're a gift to you from many researchers and organizations combined to give you a part of history of ufology that you can't read on the Internet. She wraps it up by saying, "I wish I could have done more and apologize for not doing so." Oh, geez, Wendy, your retirement really leaves a hollow, not only in the pit of my stomach, but in the whole of ufology. And you've done so much. You've been a sane, rational presence on the UFO scene for so long, there'll simply be no filling it. And I look forward to your next appearance on this program, but a blue moon seems kind of long to me. And the music that you're hearing in the background is by Alfred Lemberg. It's called A Song for Wendy. It's uploaded at YouTube. If you go to this week's program listing, you'll find a link there to Wendy's song. Alfred Lemberg is not only a contributor to this program, a former military helicopter pilot, but he's a musician and an artist as well, as you will see when you click Wendy's song at virtuallystrange.net. Strange Days Indeed is the link there. Stephen Kaiser wrote the UFO updates list last Saturday, that the NARCAP report on the O'Hare incident last November is in its final stages of preparation. And for those who are interested, Steve Kaser says, in the formal investigation, at least in the opinion of some, the current news portion of the NARCAP webpage indicates that they are nearing a release. And they also acknowledge the difficulties created by so many researchers calling authorities, as well as the problem of the federal agencies giving knee-jerk responses. Look forward to that. The NARCAP site is narcap.org, and perhaps on the next program, Don Ledger may have an update on the O'Hare situation. And talking of O'Hare, there have been a whole bunch of requests from subscribers who missed the two broadcast programs that featured that case earlier this year. So adjust your earpieces and back we go, first to January 6th and then to January the 20th.
Here with his take on it is Dave Furlong.
On November the 7th, 2006, an incident took place at Chicago's O'Hare Airport, where airport workers, pilots, and other flight crew witnessed something in the sky that they could not readily identify. I'm referring to this as Incident at O'Hare because there are a number of different posts about this on the UFO updates list. Most of the posts give us details about what happened, what was witnessed, who witnessed this event, and criticize the very cavalier, tongue-in-cheek reports that have come out from several elements of the major media, including the Associated Press. When you combine those reports with investigation or lack thereof by skeptobunkers, you get a very funny story. As they would like us to believe, a bunch of ground personnel, pilots, and other witnesses saw a round object hovering at about 1,700 feet over O'Hare Airport, and then without warning, it rose upward at a very fast rate of speed and basically disappeared. It seems that the official story being presented for the incident is that it was probably an occurrence of ice crystals inside a cloud appearing to be a round object, and they disappeared because the air warmed and they melted. Now, please note that I said probably, which is what the skeptobunkers are saying. And that includes two of my very favorites, James Oberg, spokespuppy for NASA, and another favorite, Joe Nickel, the man who puts the phrase scientific investigation into the group known formerly as PSYCOP. Oh, and incidentally, they've changed the scientific investigation part of their name now. It would appear that they figured it out. Why claim to do something that you weren't doing anyway? Now PSYCOP is known only as CSI, or Committee for Skeptical Inquiry. In other words, ask what it was, and then don't bother believing it, because surely there is some rational explanation for it. The part of the incident at O'Hare that truly frosts me now is that Joe Nickel appeared on CNN with one of the ground crew witnesses, and some very interesting facts surfaced. The most interesting was the FAA does not have the power to investigate. Excuse me? The Federal Aviation Association does not have the power to investigate something that takes place in the airspace of one of the world's largest international airports. Okay, then who does? Or maybe they're just accepting the proclamation by people who weren't even in the area that it was nothing more than just some little tiny weather anomaly. Now, as somebody who once spent more time in airplanes than I did on the ground, a fact like the FAA not having the power to investigate something at a major airport makes me very nervous. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that the incident at O'Hare should have had the FAA grounding aircraft all over North America like they did on September the 11th, 2001, but I also don't think they should be just brushing this thing away because someone, without benefit investigation or talking to anybody that saw the incident, says that it was nothing more than probably some kind of weather anomaly. Another thing that makes my hackles rise is spokespuppy Oberg, making a statement about the validity of the witnesses. Oberg argues that the professionals don't always make the best eyewitnesses, because they tend to favor flight-related explanations for what they see. NTSB investigators say that the worst observers of an aviation accident are aviation personnel, Oberg said. It's because a pilot will usually want to understand what happened, and in his initial perceptions and later retellings, will stress the facts that support his initial interpretation. It's traditional Oberg ploy. When you can't find an explanation for the event, try to cast doubt on the veracity of the eyewitnesses. The reason that this incident is being taken seriously is because people who are familiar with things in the air, like planes, helicopters, birds, including pelicans, saw something they could not identify. It's really simple. A bunch of reputable witnesses saw something they can't explain that was in a place that could interfere with public safety. So instead of immediately jumping to conclusions about what it was, perhaps some people with credible credentials that have the power should investigate the incident and thereby get some evidence that could let all of us know what happened. But that's just my take on it.
Dave Furlong, every week at this time. Strange days, indeed.
James Oberg, NASA spokespuppy. What I found interesting was the way that Oberg led off his comments on this. He says, the evidence that's come to light so far isn't all that compelling.
Yeah.
Excuse me?
No. These guys just were, you know, it's not that important or that interesting.
Yeah.
They just happened to stop what they were doing for no particular reason.
Yeah, they just needed an in-between coffee break. The evidence isn't all that compelling. You know where somebody like Oberg is going when he starts out his comments on a case with that term.
Uh-huh.
That compelling.
Yeah, or when he takes the shots at the witnesses.
Yeah.
He always does that. As soon as he can't immediately come up with an explanation for it, he takes a shot at the witness.
What I loved was the fact that Joe Nickel, spelled N-I-C-K-E-L, was on Anderson Cooper 360,
mm-hmm,
on Friday night. They misspelled his name.
Yeah.
And then in the transcript of that interview between Cooper and Nickel, they kept misspelling his name. I posted the transcript to UFO Updates and kept the misspelling. And so far, only one person has picked up on that, and that's Bob Schell, the photographer, the man with eyes like a hawk. It's quite a brilliant choice, a change of name, too, for them, CSI.
Mm-hmm.
Or as David Grinspoon called it when he was on this program, tissue television. I think we're going to get into this in quite some depth in the next 90 minutes or so as the program progresses with both Peter Davenport, who was Joe, as he was called. He was the one that originally reported it to the National UFO Reporting Center. And it was because of Peter Davenport that the story got out at all. And unfortunately, Newport got very little credit for being the source of that originally the beginning.
They were too busy in the major networks poking fun at it.
Anderson Cooper did an admirable job of making fun. And what the heck, I ask, Nickel was doing on CNN talking about anything to do with aviation just beats the heck out of me. Not only is he a lousy scientist, but he's a rotten aviation observer, too. He knows about as much aviation as my poor old grandpa. It's just really silly. And it continues. But the good thing about it is that particular incident has been brought resoundingly to the public's attention.
That's true.
Around the world. And some of the fatuous. Well, we'll get into some of that with Peter and Don Ledger and maybe even Alfred Lindbergh toward the end of the program. I mean, some of the, you know, the FAA. Oh, it must have been a weather phenomenon. And this thing took off into an overcast sky at tremendous speed and literally punched a hole into the clouds overhead. and left the hole there. Dave Frelott, thank you, sir.
Thank you.
We'll talk to you next week.
For sure.
We got to go.
Okay.
Good night.
Good night.
Been looking forward to this moment probably since the UFO over O'Hare International Airport in Chicago first broke. And it broke only just recently as far as many people are concerned, but actually happened back in November of last year. And the first report went to Peter Davenport of the National UFO Reporting Center in Washington State. It suddenly occurred to me in the midst of this week that it would probably be a good idea to get Peter back on the program. It's been a year since he's been here. Joining us on the line is one of my favorite people in the field, Peter Davenport. Good evening, sir.
Good evening, Errol. Nice to hear your voice. It's nice to be back on this program, and I'm just delighted to be here tonight and prepared to talk about this fascinating case over O'Hare and other subjects as well.
Good. Let's at the same time as we bring in Peter, let's bring in Don Ledger. Many of our listeners will know exactly who Don is. He's our East Coast correspondent, a pilot himself. He's the Canadian rep for NARCAP, the National Aviation Reporting Center on Anomalous Phenomena, headed up by Dr. Richard Haynes down there in the United States, specifically for pilots, air traffic people, radar operators, to report anonymously any aerial phenomena that they come across during the course of their duties. Good evening, Don Ledger. Welcome back to the program.
Good evening, Errol. Good evening, Peter.
Good evening, Don.
Let's go back, Peter Davenport, to November 2006. What was the sequence of events as far as you were concerned?
Well, just briefly, our center here in Washington State received a report from a party of the sighting over O'Hare Airport. We received it shortly after the incident had occurred. If you'd allow me, I'd like to blur the timing a little bit, since mm-hmm. people's jobs are potentially in jeopardy over this issue.
Absolutely.
And because of the aviation nature of this, and because it clearly was a case that deserved follow-up investigation immediately, I called Dr. Richard Haynes, again, chief scientist for NARCAP, narcap.org, knowing fully well that this would fall squarely in his bailiwick with regard to aviation safety. I had the information to Dick within a matter of minutes, maybe seconds, of my hanging up after my first conversation with our principal source on this case. And in short order, Dick and I apprised John Schussler of the Mutual UFO Network, also Dr. Mark Rodiger of the Center for UFO Studies, to let them know of this very dramatic sighting and to coordinate an investigation. So that, in a nutshell, is what happened.
With all the media coverage that we've had, the number of witnesses seems to have dwindled somewhat to this UFO over O'Hare Airport.
If you're alluding to the pressure that employers have brought against their employees to remain silent, yes, indeed, that has occurred. And in fact, we know a little bit more than we have published on our website about that issue. And without a doubt, you are correct. The respective employers have strongly urged their employees to say nothing about this case, and the threat of that has been both overt as well as implied. So, and the company, moreover, the airline involved, which I haven't identified, but I understand others have,
mm-hmm.
has refused permission to put people in touch with the pilot and first officer who allegedly saw that object directly above the cockpit of their aircraft. So it's interesting how, on one hand, the airline says, no, 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 it didn't occur. We don't know what you're talking about. And on the other hand, they're doing everything in their power to prevent contact with the people who allegedly were involved in the sighting. Very peculiar.
The pilot who saw it above his aircraft, his plane was on the ground at the time.
Correct.
And most of, in fact, all of the witnesses were on the ground. No reports of any other aircraft in the air that I'm aware of have come forth yet.
That is my understanding, mm-hmm. too, Errol. It's important to recognize, though, that the overcast at the time, the bottom of the overcast, and it was thick overcast, to the best of my knowledge, was at 1,900 feet above ground level. So aircraft in the unless they were landing or taking off, would have been above that altitude anyway, so they would not have been able to see this object as it hovered over the airport.
The main witness, and the gentleman who has the pseudonym Joe, who was on CNN, he said that he was towing, and I think it was a United Airlines aircraft.
Yes.
And it was United Airlines whose terminal this thing was hanging over, because the Chicago Tribune reporter, John Hilkovich, had mentioned the airline's name in his article in the Tribune. The guy who was on CNN last night, Joe, was taxiing an aircraft from the terminal back to the hangars when he saw the object.
Yes.
Actually, a very articulate man told the story really well and concisely.
Yes. You are exactly correct, Errol. This guy is very reliable. He's very straightforward. In fact, he has exposed himself to no mean risk to his job security by bringing this information to the fore, and I have the same impression of him that you do. His experience in the aviation field, and this is a significant point, I believe, measures in decades, not just years, and therefore he is a qualified witness in addition to being a reliable witness, and moreover, he is viewed to be reliable enough by his company that he is licensed to many times a day taxi aircraft that are valued in the hundreds of millions of dollars. He was taxiing a 777. I understand that the CNN interview showed him taxiing a 737. In point of fact, it was a 777, Boeing 777. And his testimony actually gives us reinforcement about the FAA's participation in this, because initially they said, we didn't receive any reports. But we know that's incorrect, because this mechanic first learned of the presence or alleged presence of this object over his radio as he was taxiing the aircraft. And he looked up, and yes, indeed, there was a metallic-looking, dark-colored object hovering over gate C-17, and he watched it for a considerable period of time. When he taxied his airplane, he looked back to the same area, and he saw the reported hole in the overcast that this object apparently generated as it accelerated straight up and disappeared from everyone's sight.
And there are a number of discrepancies as far as the airline is concerned, as far as the Federal Aviation Authority spokesperson are concerned. The timing was of the incident and the time at which this disc took off and punched its way through the cloud, leaving a hole there. They had put it after dark. If it were after dark, then you couldn't see the hole in the clouds.
Yeah.
So obviously the sun had not yet set. It was not yet dark when people were observing this. As you said, there were a lot of witnesses. Joe had said that there was a lot of chatter on the ground communications.
So interestingly, if this was a weather aberration, as the FAA has declared, and if in fact the event did not occur as the airline claimed, at least initially, why then are they trying to cover it up, and why are they denying access to some of the people who actually saw it, and they're encouraging those people, moreover, not to say anything? That is very curious by itself.
And the beat goes on, as it inevitably does around situations like this. Don, what do you make of what we've discussed so far?
I wonder about the legality, what's going on with these United Airline workers. We all know that now.
Mm-hmm.
It's been published in the Tribune and all over the many different newspaper reports that I've seen, plus in aviation periodicals too, well, online periodicals. AV Web has carried a couple of stories on it.
And that's unusual, because they never touch UFOs.
Oh, no, not to my knowledge. Anyway, uh-huh. First time for me. The fact that these people are denied the right to speak about something at a public airport boggles the mind. I know they work for United Airlines, but that doesn't give United Airlines the right to shut them up. I know they're going to do it to pilots. There's already a self-protective thing that kicks in with pilots, particularly airline pilots, when these occur. Self-preservation, if you want to call it. I don't find that to be as big a problem with private pilots as it is with airline pilots. And, of course, the military pilots, they've got protocols in place to tell them to keep their mouths shut if they have to. I don't want to sound like a paranoid about this, but, I mean, it's been going on for some time now. And as to why the FAA would come out with such a wishy-washy explanation for this thing, their media person who comes out, to probably knows nothing about it, to explain away it is some kind of a weather anomaly, you know, it's pure nonsense. There's a lot of confusion about radar and whether it would have been on radar. I doubt if any radar at Chicago itself would have picked up anything that close.
And that low. High. Yes, yes, yes.
Airline was talking about this earlier today, Peter, but it would be similar to a person standing in the center of a room and then turning around and with their eyes towards the ceiling going all the way around, and somebody drops a piece of lint on their head. Well, they can't see the lint on top of their head any more than the radar could see
That's
this
right.
thing if it was right above the airport, particularly at 1,900 feet.
Yeah.
And not only that, radar coverage at an airport is so cluttered that close in that you're virtually impossible to see anything on there. Pilots don't turn on their transponders, and you know they're on standby. They don't normally turn them on. You know this yourself. Till they get about 5 miles out, because the transponder code that would come up even on primary, there'd be so many little quarter-inch dots all over the screen, you never make anything out anyway.
Yeah.
As for the weather phenomenon, how many times do we have to listen to this kind of nonsense before people start taking it seriously? You know.
Yeah. I'd like to address the weather phenomenon, and then I'd like to come back to the radar, Don, and ask a few questions, because I think you know vastly more about aviation radar than I do. But the fact that the witnesses reported that the object accelerated so fast when it suddenly disappeared from their sight that they could not be certain which direction it had gone, somewhat analogous to watching a hummingbird that suddenly accelerates and flies off. You sometimes don't know which direction that bird has gone.
Hmm.
But I don't know any weather phenomenon that accelerates to that degree. The only reason we know what direction that object went, I guess two reasons. Number one is the hole in the overcast above it gives us some idea as to the track it took through the atmosphere. But the other fact is that the first witness to this object was a ramp worker who was standing at the nose of an aircraft. He was looking straight up almost. It was almost directly above his head. And when it suddenly accelerated and disappeared from his sight, because it was going almost directly away from him, he was the only one who was able to see, so far as I am aware, was able to see what direction it had gone.
Hmm.
So I don't know any lenticular cloud or orographic fog or anything like that. No meteorological condition is going to accelerate so suddenly that people can't see how it disappeared.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
So
here's another thing we can eliminate, too, is weather balloons. That's been brought up the odd time around airports. Now, these are major international airports, and most major international airports don't use weather balloons anymore. They use heliometers. You know, they're laser-driven. With a mirror, receiving mirror, and they can actually see through the first cloud layer up into the second, third, fourth, you know, and record those so that you actually know what's above your airfield. There are two towers at Chicago here. There's the old control tower, which is now the ground control tower. Somebody had mentioned the other day about them. They were uncertain whether ground control actually saw anything on the ground. Well, of course, all of these people belong to air traffic control, right? But they're tower controllers and they're ground controllers, and often they switch duties. I know in smaller airports, your ground controller might taxi to the hold position at a runway and then tell you when you finish your run up to contact tower on the tower frequency. And when you contact tower, it's the same guy. So they share duties back and forth. Now there's a new tower at Chicago O'Hare. It's about 250 feet above the ground. So they have a good view around. But there again, if either one of these towers happens to be directly underneath this particular object that we're talking about, they probably wouldn't be able to see it through the roof. That's the only problem I have. But we haven't been able to establish exactly, you know, the positions on the ground as to whether that would be the case or not. When they were talking on the ground, there was a lot of radio traffic flying around from the ground handlers and probably the pilots. I'm not an expert on radar, although I did work on it when I was younger. It's changed a heck of a lot since, but I know enough about it as it pertains to air traffic control and how they work it. Any radar that was being watched at and around the airport would have been tower radar. if they were watching at all, which they probably are, any traffic that's just been handed off to them from either low-level or high-level control, air traffic control. And there again, although the radar site is to the west of the tower somewhere, so we haven't been able to actually nail down that position, and it's almost like it's a closely held secret, and I'm not trying to be paranoid about that, it's just hard to find out. The actual people who are receiving information from that radar are about 30 miles away in another building, and this is very common. So they're not actually there. So if anybody asked them if they saw anything out the window, well, they didn't see anything out the window because they don't have windows. If anybody was likely to have been contacted first, it was probably ground control. The ground vehicles, when they have to cross a runway or go across the apron, and these places are extremely busy, that Chicago area, you know, Atlanta, Heathrow, Kennedy and so on, it's incredible. So they just can't go tearing off across anywhere unless they clear it with ground control. So ground control is in the loop all the time, and they're looking out the windows, and they're watching everything that's going on as best they can, because they want to make sure they're not getting any traffic conflict, you know, somebody's going to rub a wing against another airplane or worse.
It seems to me that they must have heard the chatter on the radio.
Well, they would have, yeah.
At that point, you and I and Peter Davenport and pretty much everybody else listening, you're in the tower and you hear, look, there's something up there over United Airlines terminal. All eyes would be riveted to whatever was going on there, and especially when you're 100 feet off the ground and you can see very clearly what's going on.
I really don't have any doubt that they probably were able to see it. If there was anything there at all and it wasn't being obstructed by a building, which I doubt, because that's the reason why they're sticking up so high, is to avoid that problem, unless it was at an angle to prevent them from seeing it because of the roof being in the way of the tower, and the tower being in the way, then they probably did see it. I can't see how they couldn't, and I imagine tower did too.
It seems to me that many of the cases where you get sightings near radar installations, and this has been over the years, often the radar just does not see anything, even if an object would be within the viewing range of the radar.
Yeah, well, at close range like that, I doubt if it would see it anyway.
There's one exception. It seems to me, Don, and correct me if I'm wrong, that you are addressing the type of radar that detects aircraft in the air. But modern airports, am I correct in saying, now have a very high-frequency radar? For example, here at SeaTac Airport near Seattle, they have a very high-speed antenna on the top of the tower. It rotates at between 1 and 2 rotations per second, very high speed. And it is expressly for measuring objects that are on the ground. It is a ground control radar.
Right.
And are you familiar with that type of radar?
Yeah.
And do you know what altitude the radar lobe being transmitted might reach up to at that distance on an airport?
This came through to me today from Martin Sowell in England, who's very familiar with radar. It's a 30-second refresh rate. It's an ASR-9 Northrop Grumman radar at Chicago.
Yeah.
This is the short-range one, with a 40-mile radius. All right, so that's probably pretty much within the tower control zone inside of that. I'm trying to think at Chicago, I think they're 17 to 20 miles out. That's at the bottom of the wedding cake, too. I'm not talking about anything above there. And there's weather radar as well. But the problem is being able to see anything that close in, like a piece of dust on the lens of your camera. When you get it close enough, it pretty much ignores it. It blurs out to the point, that it's... But that's not to say that it couldn't be picked up.
In the CNN coverage on the Anderson 360 program last night, there was a close-up of the tower, and on top of the tower was this white dome physically attached that was spinning really fast, and I thought, aha, that's ground radar, I said to myself as that footage went by.
I wanted to come back to the radar issue because there are different types of radars.
Oh, for sure.
Don addressed the ASR-9 radar. That is a very sensitive digital radar that is designed for detecting aircraft when they're in the air. But modern airports now have radars that are expressly for looking at aircraft while they're sitting on the tarmac. And my question is whether Don knows what kind of radar they have there for looking at aircraft on the radar.
If they do, I suspect that, Errol, if you saw something on TV, there's the possibility of some new radar, and on top of the tower, it makes sense because that way there's no blind spot for them.
Yeah, covered in a white rotating plastic
right.
dome,
yeah.
And the seams were spinning around pretty darn fast.
When you say fast, would you say one sweep every 12 seconds? Maybe?
Oh, faster than
no,
that.
It's, okay.
Much
it's
faster.
One to two sweeps per second.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that fast. Okay. Then,
yeah.
Then it's probably something new that it's not being picked up, it hasn't shown up on the Internet yet, for one thing. I know they're having they've been having problems with radar outage at Chicago, but that's the other stuff. That would make sense to have that high-speed spinning radar so that you can watch what's going on the ground, and you hardly get any fade out of the image
yeah, yeah.
that's coming back from it.
It updates on every sweep, updates
yeah.
the screen,
yeah.
and the only remaining question is whether the lobe, that is the transmitted electromagnetic radiation, would reach up to the altitude
yeah.
where this object was sitting as it swept over it. If an air traffic controller in a tower, as opposed to in an air route traffic control center,
right.
would simply go to his screen that he watches aircraft on the ground with and simply ask or look to see whether this object was visible on the screen.
Yeah. Well, I doubt that they probably do see up to 1,900 feet with that radar. Possibly they do, but it's downward looking.
It
you know,
makes me wonder whether they might have tuned it,
yeah.
whether they might have a knob that allows them to change where it looks and just look up and see if they
yeah.
saw the object.
That's a possibility, too.
Yeah.
Could...
So after the sighting, was there any unconventional aircraft reported flying in the area?
I don't know the answer to the question, but Don can address the nature of Class B airspace. Probably knows more about it than I do, even though I'm a commercial pilot here down in the U.S. There would have been no aircraft that would have penetrated the airspace around O'Hare unless it was coming to or taking off from the airport. I can't imagine that any kind of military aircraft went after this object, but I'm not aware of anything.
I suspect whatever this was, if it was moving that fast, maybe nobody had any time to react to it, but I bet you it was reported. I should ask Peter if he got any hint or a whiff of NORAD being contacted about this.
Yeah, I was going to ask about Cheyenne Mountain.
Mm-hmm. I have no information whatsoever on that point,
mm-hmm.
but I agree. The FAA is set up, I'm sure it's the same in Canada now,
yeah.
such that if one single air traffic controller begins to suspect something, I'll bet either he or she or the supervisor to that person has the ability today to pick up a telephone handset and talk directly to
NORAD.
The military or local military and or NORAD.
And probably even feed them the signal that they're getting on their scope, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good point as well.
Mm-hmm.
There's just an example of that. And I think, did we talk about this, Errol, maybe back a few weeks ago, about a transponder return that was coming in at was squawking 1003?
That sounds familiar.
Yeah, this is at Dorval and at Mirabel Airport in Quebec. And but it was right on the threshold, right at about 500 feet above the threshold of runway 24 at Mirabel in Montreal, and stayed there for, it was an hour and 16 minutes, and they were getting a transponder code, but there was nothing there, but there was a code coming in. Very unusual, you know. And it did say in CADORS, that's a Canadian aviation incident reporting, every day it goes on, you get about anywhere between 25 and 70 of them, but this particular one happened to be the UFO type or a TCAS warning or something like that, and it just said that was reported to NORAD. NORAD advised. And in three or four different cases I've run across that here, I don't doubt whenever they get one of these and it's unusual, they just dump it in NORAD's lap and let them look after it.
So what you're saying is that there was an anomalous object squawking...
transponder code 3,
and
at
they,
night, of course, naturally.
Yeah, and all they could see was the transponder code and no physical shape around it.
It was just a transponder code coming in like it was coming from an airplane, but it was just fixed in one spot, and it was being picked up both at Dorval and at Mirabel.
There's a whole other weather anomaly for you, huh? It's
very
totally
unusual.
Ridiculous. Let's take a call here. Raj, good evening. Welcome back to Strange Days Indeed.
Yes, good evening, gentlemen. I have two quick questions for Mr. Davenport. My first one is, I've come across rumors online that somebody may have taken a picture of the phenomenon, but they are... afraid to come forward because they're afraid of losing their job. Second question is, I know that the Tribune reporter Hilkovich had issued an FOI a Freedom of Information request against the FAA, and I'm curious to know whether there will be a follow-up report on that with perhaps some details of the chatter and that sort of thing.
My understanding is that at least one photograph was taken, possibly two. It is reported by Mr. Hilkovich, I think, that the pilot of the aircraft above which this object allegedly was hovering at gate C-17 on the C concourse leaned out of the window of his aircraft, and he pointed I presume a digital camera up at the object and took a photograph. This is why we would very much like to talk to the pilot and first officer of that airliner, and the airline involved is denying, as my understanding is, denying access to those people, even though individuals who either did see the object and or who were involved in reporting it to the FAA and higher up in their company know perfectly well who these cockpit crew members are. So the other photograph may have been taken, in fact we're pretty sure it was taken with a cell phone camera, so the quality of photography may not be very good, but there may have been two pictures. And the interesting thing about two pictures is you can use that information for triangulation if there were fixed objects inside the in the frames of the pictures. So perhaps two. And in ufology, my experience is out of 1,000 people who see an object like this, only one or so will ever come forward. So we'll never know how many other witnesses and how many other photos there may be out there.
And so, the other question on the Freedom of Information Act that John Hilkovich asked for.
Yes, there have been at least three people, three sources submit FOIA requests. I think Dr. Richard Haynes of NARCAP, with whom Don works very closely, I'm sure, submitted an FOIA request in very, very short order. Don is probably aware of that and working with that issue. Also, another party from the state of Washington submitted a request. So the nice thing about all those requests is it requires the FAA to freeze the data, freeze the tapes, and so on and so forth in place, which will give them time to go through them and search for the data requested. So at least as far as I know, these requests will cause the FAA to lock all of that data, freeze it in time, if you will, and, for example, not re-record over the same tapes and destroy the original data.
Yeah, that's John Hilkovich made the request earlier on because he couldn't get any information on that, and then the story resulted, I think, after he got his put the FOIA.
And I want to stress once again that the original source for this story was the National UFO Reporting Center,
yeah,
where
exactly.
Joe, the primary witness and the reliable witness, the man who has worked around Chicago for many, many years around the airport there, and therefore it is a reliable and trusted observer. He knows what should and shouldn't be in the sky over Chicago, and he knows what he's accustomed to seeing there. I want to bring Alfred Lemberg into the conversation now, regular contributor to this program. He lives down there in Alabama and is a keen observer of things ufological. Good evening, Alfred.
The listeners should begin to feel some rage.
Oh, Alfred, a former military chopper pilot.
Yeah.
So a gathering of pilots, and none of you presumably buy the story from the FAA that what people observed was a weather anomaly.
This just in, it's a Newsweek exclusive with Peter Davenport, The Mystery Lingers Over Chicago UFO Claims. And just on a quick scan through the story, I can say that it seems like they let Mr. Davenport pretty much have his say. However, as an answer to why things, you know, might be hidden, well, it's that giggle factor that we're always talking about. And with regard to that, the Newsweek site has put up a picture of flying saucers hazarding the Capitol in Earth versus the flying saucers. Oh, let's all have a smart laugh. What ho!
That's always a problem, isn't it? You notice just about every newspaper story that comes out these days has to have a little bit of a leader. Have aliens landed on Earth, and then they go into the story. You know, it's almost like their get-out-of-jail-free card, you know, that they put right at the very first, just in case their fellow reporters or whatever happen to bring it up and say, well, you know, it was tongue-in-cheek article type of thing.
Yes.
But let's talk to Peter about that. He did the Newsweek article. How were you treated, Peter?
The young woman who did that article was very serious-minded. There are a few anomalies that occurred that I'd prefer not to go into, but I read the article, or at least the first several questions that she posed to me, and she quoted me exquisitely accurately.
Right.
So it's a very good article in that respect. But I'd like to interject a sort of a new subject here, if I may, Errol.
Go ahead, Peter, yes.
If anybody were to ask a person who listens to Strange Days Indeed or any other radio program, people who've known me or come to know me as a UFO investigator over the last 12 and a half years that I've been doing this job, if you were to ask them, what does Peter Davenport do, their response would be, well, it's obvious he's a UFO investigator who brings this information to the public forum.
Mm-hmm.
In point of fact, until a few years ago, I might have said the same thing, but I'm beginning to think that it was more correct to say that I am an observer of extraordinarily bizarre human behavior which occurs in response to the apparent presence of UFOs on our planet. And people will say, well, what does that mean? What that means is that the press goes berserk when an event like this occurs. As Alfred just pointed out, they have to incorporate the laugh factor into it. Other peculiar things that people do is engage in denial. Oh, that couldn't have occurred. The witnesses clearly were wrong, even though the judge of all of this has never talked to a witness or never was not there to see the object, him or herself. So it is, I think, correct to say that I am an observer of bizarre human behavior in relation to the UFO phenomenon. The one thing that intrigues me even more than the question of whether UFOs are present on our planet or not is the behavior of the press, why it ignores the phenomenon, or if it happens to cover a UFO event or two, why they spurn it, they lampoon it. The coverage is just almost childlike. In
Amen, yay, and verily, sir.
You tilt at windmills. I quite often I see these things. They get posted on SDI and some other places, or I just see them, on some of the newspaper sites, and I might respond to the editor email-wise, or even to the reporter, and I'd say maybe 1 in 10 times I get a response. I don't know whether these things ever show up. Usually they're in the United States or something. It's almost as if there's a handbook out there on how to write a newspaper story about a perceived UFO report.
That's not enough anymore.
No, it's not.
That's,
I mean,
ridiculous.
It's
not
that.
Enough of an excuse for me. I require, nay, demand something more.
Yeah. Well, I think we all do. We don't get it. To me, it's an insult to the people who at least had the guts to come out and say, well, look, this is what happened to me, or this is what I saw, and particularly when you get into the highly technical areas like flight and space and so on. Shouldn't these people be given at least the benefit of the doubt? And here's another little thing you just mentioned a little while ago about, you know, where's this stuff going? Who's behind this? Errol brought this up. And who's slapping it down? Who's slapping the FAA down? That knee-jerk response they came out with when we had to. It's just that, a knee-jerk response. It's hardly even reasoned out. It's almost like they know they can get away with any weak-kneed foolishness they come up with, and everybody else has to eat it. You know, I don't know why we do. It's amazing to me.
Cordy Bryan, C.D.D. Bryan, who wrote the book on the MIT abduction conference several years ago now, and who went to MIT to attend the conference as a complete skeptic, and came away as completely convinced that something was going on, once said on a broadcast program, if I were the Secretary of the Air Force and these things were flying in and out of my airspace and I could do nothing about it, then I'd deny that there was anything at all going on.
And I'll tell you, there's some high-profile folks that are indicating just that.
to include Robert Hastings, to include Stanton Friedman, to include Frank Pacino, to include Richard Dolan. It's not just us here on this program discussing this as some kind of thing that should be looked at. There's an increasing number of people in an increasing amount of disciplines that are becoming interested in this thing, and I see it as an acceleration in the year 2007.
I often wonder, when I get on this radio program, how many pilots actually might have tuned in, or maybe coming back from the job at the airport or something like that, who have had a sighting. I know we all get reports from pilots, but it's usually surreptitiously. But how many are listening to this program maybe tonight and want to contact somebody and say, listen, I got a story to tell, and I just want to get it out there and get it off my chest, because a lot of them, that's just what they want to do. And they want to, here's three of us, four of us right here right now that they can get it off their chest with them. We're not going to tell anybody that they don't want us to tell anybody. And we just want to know about them, because it just adds, you know, grist to the mill, I guess. But whether we do anything about it, I don't know.
SDI at virtuallystrange.net will reach any of these gentlemen. You can go to the National UFO Reporting Center's website, which is, Peter, help me with this, because my monitor is failing
me. Simply UFOcenter.com, 9 letters, 1 word. And we spell it the way the Americans spell it, UFOcenter.com.
UFOcenter.com is the place to go if you are a pilot, if you are air traffic, and you want to make a report. You can do so anonymously, or you can leave your name with Peter, and Peter will not pass it on to anyone. SDI at virtuallystrange.net. I shall pass it on to Don Ledger. His website will be up very shortly now. His wife is out of town for a few weeks. Peter, we have about 2.5 minutes left. Is there anything else that you'd like to add to the O'Hare story?
Just briefly, one point we haven't touched on, the irony that on one hand, the Federal Aviation Regulation here down south of the border directs people inside the U.S., to our organization, whether they be pilots, FAA employees, or citizens. The interesting thing about this case is that on the other hand, now this case was so dramatic that they are trying to prevent people from being alerted to this incident.
Good
point. A peculiar irony.
Very strange. Very strange indeed. But then that's often the way it is, isn't it? Is frustrates with facts.
Yeah.
It's intolerable.
Clouding.
Governments seem to do what governments wish to do.
Mm-hmm. Clouding the issue with facts or non-facts.
Yes.
Yes.
Intolerable. Outraging. I mean, to the point of the stuttering stage.
Peter, how much of it do you think might have to do with airlines being really antsy today because there's, you know, because of the terrorists? They're already dealing with that. They've lost airline passengers. They're trying to gain that back over the last since 9/11.
Yep.
And how much of that do you think they just don't want their pilots talking about this sort of thing because it's just something else that a passenger's got to think about, might be afraid of?
Absolutely. I suspect that plays a large role in this. United Airlines just coming out of bankruptcy now, like so many other airlines around the world. But I think the overriding issue is that of self-censorship.
Mm-hmm.
Canada and the U.S., free countries, people ostensibly are able to say what they wish, free from harassment from their government, and yet people nevertheless go back in their caves, even though they have precious information that they think might be crucial for an investigation like this.
Yeah.
Gentlemen, we have come to the end of our time together. I want to thank you, Peter Davenport, for being with us and for the work that you do.
Thank you.
Invaluable, and long may you continue to do it. I trust that you will pass on any subsequent facts that come to the surface over this UFO sighting.
I will indeed.
Thank you,
Errol.
Thanks, Peter. And remember, folks, the story originated with the National UFO Reporting Center. Don Ledger, thank you. We shall
talk to
you again in a couple of weeks, as we shall talk with Alfred Lemberg. Good night, gentlemen. Now, a couple of weeks ago, we talked with Peter Davenport at the National UFO Reporting Center in Washington State about the O'Hare case and how frustrated he had become in trying to get the press to cover the story, and what a relief it was for him when John Hilkovich got interested. And we thought it would be a good idea to get a hold of John and get his take sorry, Dave, on the situation. So joining us on the line from his home down there in Illinois is the Chicago Tribune's columnist, John Hilkovich. Good evening, John.
Good evening to you.
It's good to talk to you in person, having seen you all over the boob tube for a couple of weeks now. Pretty amazing reaction to your initial story, huh?
Yeah, it really is. I mean, I've been at Chicago Tribune 28 years, the last 10 or 11 on the transportation beat, and I've had a number of, big stories, stories that I consider very important, and including a team that I led that won the Pulitzer Prize in 2001 for a series about gridlock in the aviation industry. But nothing has received the attention, both in the United States and around the world, as this story about the sighting on November 7th at O'Hare.
I mean, even CNN almost managed a relatively straight-faced pair of stories on it. It was without too much goofing around. How did you get involved in this story, John Hilkovich?
Well, O'Hare is part of my beat covering transportation. I cover everything from aviation to ground transportation, roads, mass transit, land use planning, you name it.
Mm-hmm.
And I was contacted by Peter Davenport in early November, shortly after this incident. And I had never, frankly, heard of him or his organization. I later learned that, it is very reputable and, in this field. Mm-hmm. And in fact, when the FAA gets any kind of report, it refers UFO reports to Davenport's group among one or two others. I was skeptical because, again, I'm not an expert on UFOs. I mean, if you want to talk about O'Hare expansion or any other subject, I could go on for hours. But this is something that I really got my feet wet just with this story. So I was leery. I wanted to interview the two witnesses that Peter had, face to face, and I wanted to develop my own witnesses, which I did, and also get some intercept some documentation from United Airlines, which in fact showed that despite United's denials that they even knew anything about this, they in fact not only knew but took it seriously and interviewed, really interrogated a number of their employees, had them write reports, narratives, even in some cases draw pictures of what they saw. So with all that in hand, the documentation, the interviews, I was satisfied, my editors were satisfied to go to print on the first of the year with a story that was largely, unsourced as far as we didn't name any of the witnesses because all of them had been, threatened by United Airlines not to talk because there would be repercussions if they did.
Oh, really? United Airlines threatened their employees?
Well, I mean, they warned them. They said, we don't want you talking, to the media. We don't know if this story is going to get out. But there was a keen sense of concern by, some United officials. And I don't know if they were worried about being embarrassed. I don't know. I don't know what the embarrassment is because these people did exactly what their job is, which is if they report anything unusual at the airport, there might be either a safety or a security issue that they should report it up the chain.
I'm not sure that I'd heard that the United employees had been advised not to talk about it publicly.
They still are. Since the story came out, have developed additional witnesses at the airport, and they've all been told, do not talk about this. In fact, one of the pilots that was being pushed back from gate C-17, which is directly underneath where this object, allegedly was observed, gave me a fantastic interview, and he agreed to be photographed. He agreed to have his name used. And then at the last minute, he says, let me just check this with my captain at the O'Hare domicile. And as soon as he said that to me, I knew the answer was going to be no. And, of course, it was. So I haven't gone with that story because I don't want to harm his employment. But I'm hoping when I get Freedom of Information data back from the FAA that I then will go to United again and try to convince them to let this first officer talk publicly.
I don't understand why United Airlines why any airline would lean on their ground crews and pilots and suggest that if they talk to the media, they're careers might be in jeopardy, which is what it seems has happened with United and their people.
Well, you know, I can't explain it either, other than to surmise that, you know, here's an airline that's just recently come out of bankruptcy. The entire airline industry is still struggling from 9/11. The shakeout is still occurring. There are going to be airlines that are going to disappear. There is going to be airline consolidation. And I think someone in either the media relations department at United or higher up in the executive office has decided this is the kind of attention that they don't want.
That's ridiculous. Dave?
Oh, to say something like that to their people and to hope that they would not in turn say, you know, by the way, I've been told not to talk about this.
Unfortunately, it was very real, and I've had to withhold some information that I've had from documentation and elsewhere, because it really would come down to fingering, you know, one or two individuals.
Yeah.
Because you know, these were not, I mean, these were pilots. These are individuals that, you know, 30 miles out could see a dot in the sky that us laymen wouldn't even see, and they could identify it as not only of an aircraft, but what direction it's moving.
Yeah,
so, they could certainly see something 1,500 feet up that they say is not a reflection of the light or any kind of weather phenomenon, which the FAA claimed, mm-hmm. but this dark gray, some said dirty gray, elliptical-shaped, metallic object in a fixed position above a gate.
That's the big key, is the fact that it wasn't a cloud or it wasn't crystals. It was a metallic object.
Right. And that's why I think the Chicago Tribune went with this story, because the credibility of these witnesses was really just unquestionable. These, you know, there was no hoax going on here. These were not individuals that were looking to get any kind of public exposure. Their job is way too important to them, whether they were ramp attendants, mechanics, pilots, even several managers who heard the chatter over the radio, over United's internal radio, thought it was crazy, but then went outside and saw it themselves.
It is crazy. These are strange days indeed. That's the voice of John Hiltovich. He's the transportation columnist for the Chicago Tribune. What was intriguing about this, John, is the fact that this thing, when it left, went up rapidly through the clouds and went through the clouds so hard that it literally cut a tunnel through the clouds so that you could see the blue sky above it.
Yes, that's the account of the witnesses, that while, you know, for 5, perhaps 10 minutes while it was in that fixed position above the gate, it did stay there. But then when it did disappear, it just streaked. And this was an overcast day. The FAA reported 1,900-foot ceilings. And this object appeared to hover just below the deck of the ceilings, so as if to be visible but not in the clouds, just below them. But when it streaked away, the description was it left with such energy and such speed that it cut a hole of blue sky in an otherwise cloudy day. And it stayed that way for several minutes until the wind pushed the clouds back together. That's just something that doesn't happen with an aircraft. I mean, an airplane slices through clouds. You know, there's wake turbulence that comes off the wings. That creates a little bit of disturbance, but certainly not this big hole that was observed here. After my story came out, I was contacted by some people in neighboring suburbs who also saw this hole in the sky and didn't make anything of it at the time other than it was very weird. And then they read the story and contacted me to say they think, some of them said they saw the object, others said they just saw the hole.
John, with the FAA's official statement saying that it was nothing more than a weather thing, did you check with your meteorological people to find out if something like that could happen?
Yeah, I did check with the National Weather Service. My main inquiry there was, you know, were there any weather balloons in the vicinity of the airport that may have strayed? And the answer was no. I did check with the military, the NORAD and such, and some of the reserve bases in southern Illinois and Missouri. They claimed they had no activity there, but I suppose they wouldn't tell me if they did. But no, I was not able to get any kind of natural explanation for this occurring.
What happened?
Some email questions, John Hiltovich. Have you yourself been coerced, or has it been suggested to you by anybody that perhaps you need to lay off this story?
Not at all. I mean, I wrote the original story that appeared New Year's Day. That following Sunday, I wrote a what we call a perspective piece in our op-ed section on Sunday. It was sort of an analysis and my interpretation of why this story got such had such worldwide appeal and why people are so fascinated with this subject. And I think the bottom line also being that, I've literally received, I stopped counting, but just hundreds and hundreds of emails and calls. People just feel that the government, the aerospace industry, certainly the military, all know more about this subject of UFOs, far more than they're willing to tell the rest of us.
And when did you come to that conclusion?
Based on all these emails and people reaching out to me.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was just widespread. There were several themes, but I'd say one of the major themes was much more is known about this and whether the government is involved in some kind of research, whether we don't want to panic the masses, whether we don't want other countries to know about what we may be working on. For whatever reason, people believe the government is not being straight.
The story was that there were a lot of pictures taken by various individuals. Come across any of those, John Hilkovich?
No, I haven't, and that's one of the troubling aspects of this. For example, at that C-17 gate, I was told by the flight crew that there were no less than 50 people, ramp workers, mechanics, and such, that saw this object and were looking up at it. My original report was at least a dozen people saw it, but I later learned that just at this one gate, more than 50 individuals saw it. And you'd think one of them would have a cell phone camera, but been unable to locate anyone with the camera. Some people off airport also thought they saw it, but none of them had a camera either. O'Hare is also ringed with security and surveillance cameras.
I bet those tapes disappeared very quickly.
No, I'm not so sure about that, but I think, unfortunately, those cameras are pointed at the airfield, and they're not really pointed at the air at all.
Hmm.
So I think that's why they missed it. But it is curious to me that when the call was made to the O'Hare control tower and the controllers were asked if they saw anything, to a person, they all said no. And controllers are one of my best sources of tips. I mean, they're always calling me about things. And they were looking directly in the area where this object would have been because they were working runway 9 left for departures at the time, and that's in the area. So why didn't controllers see it? Why didn't any employees at American Airlines, the world's largest airline with the second largest presence at O'Hare, they didn't see it either? American's operations are two terminals over. Maybe that explains it. But there are questions, why didn't the controllers see it? Why aren't there any pictures? And while there's a large number of United employees, why was it limited to them? Or was this due to some vantage point that they had?
It seems to me that nothing moves on the ground without the control tower's permission.
That's correct.
And the only way that you can communicate from your truck to the control tower is wireless, radio. And if ground crews are talking to each other about this thing that's hanging out over Terminal C, Concourse C, up in the sky, there's a flying saucer, there's a UFO up there, then surely if they're using those frequencies that control tower is listening on to move vehicles around the airport, control tower operators must have heard the chatter on the radio.
Well, they definitely heard the chatter, and I do have a Freedom of Information request into the FAA, which I'm hoping to get back any day now, that will show that chatter. So the controllers are not saying they didn't hear about it. What they're saying is what they looked up, they searched the sky, and none of them saw it.
That's a scary one as well. James Oberg from NASA basically said that pilots make poor observers, as stated by the NTSB. Any comment on that?
I guess I'd have to know they make poor observers under what circumstances.
He stated, I believe he was stating the NTSB said that they make poor observers or poor witnesses when they're investigating crashes, but he tried to tie it into them being basically poor observers, period.
I think I disagree. I mean, certainly sitting 20, 25 feet up in the cockpit of a plane, you have a different perspective than you might elsewhere. And I understand the whole human factors angle that the NTSB looks at, and that someone's perception of something may or may not be the reality. And that's why interviews are only one aspect of an NTSB investigation.
Right.
A lot of it has to be based on solid evidence, measurements, chemical studies, whatever, if those are available. So, yes, do you want to have as many venues of opportunity to investigate as possible? Of course. but in this case, what we do have is witness accounts by many people who fly in and out of that airport every day, know how the light bounces off things, and dismiss the fact that this could have been any kind of light show or any kind of weather phenomena. Just too low and too real.
John Hilkovich, thank you, sir. We be out of time together. I want to thank you for taking an interest in the story and creating a large sigh of relief among many UFO researchers. Good night, John Hilkovich. Thanks again.
It
was good to be with you, John. Thanks.
Good night, John.
Good night, Dave.
You better pray to the Lord when you see those flying saucers. It may be the coming of the judgment day. It's a sign, there's no doubt, of the trouble that's about. So I say, my friends, you'd better start to pray. They're a terrifying sight as they fly on day and night. It's a warning that we'd better mend our ways. You'd better pray to the Lord when you see those flying saucers. It may be the coming of the judgment day.
I want to remind you that if you'd care to comment, emails are welcome here at SBI, as are MP3 files. If you'd care to make a comment about what you've heard, something you've seen, then please don't hesitate to send those MP3 files to virtuallystrange.net. Next week, program 432, Stuart Miller, regular contributor, of course, Dave Berlot, John Ledger, and Dennis Balthaser. Fingers, eyes, ears, nose, and toes crossed. Dennis from Roswell, New Mexico, whose research has taken him off into some pretty interesting directions. But more about that next week. Until then, thank you for being there. Thanks for subscribing. And we'll talk to you next week. Good night.
That's this week's edition of Strange Days Indeed, hosted and produced by Errol Bruce Knapp. The executive producer is Dean Mascardelli. Send any questions or comments to sdi@virtuallystrange.net. Strange Days Indeed is the copyright of Random Fit Productions. Join us again next Saturday for more Strange Days Indeed from the Virtually Strange Network.